Welcome to Talking History. This is Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. When World War II ended, the major victorious nations of the world resolved that they would create an international institution committed to maintaining the peace. Unlike the League of Nations, established after the First World War for the same purpose, that failed within a few years, the United Nations persists. But has it been successful? Has its role changed in the post-Cold War era? That's the subject of today's interview with Professor Paul Diehl. But before we get to that, let's look back at a key event from this week in history. During this week in 1962, Hollywood blonde bombshell Marilyn Monroe died at her Los Angeles home of a suicidal overdose of sleeping pills. Throughout her troubled career, Monroe was known for her stereotypical portrayal of a dumb blonde, as well as her sensitive, articulate depiction of roles in The Asphalt Jungle and All About Eve. Born in 1926 to an unwed film cutter, Gladys Monroe Baker Mortensen, Marilyn began her long odyssey through unstable foster homes at just 2 weeks old. Throughout the trauma of sexual molestation and other abuses endured in those homes, Monroe's negative feelings of self-worthlessness were formed. Still, in working with some of the most acclaimed directors of her era, Monroe was also known for her unique ability to project a variety of different moods on screen, and at the end of her life, she was recognized throughout Hollywood circles as a survivor. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, civil rights hero Rosa Parks recently joined the likes of Mother Teresa, Nelson Mandela, and George Washington when Congress bestowed upon her the prestigious Congressional Gold Medal. The award, which is the highest civilian honor awarded by Congress, comes in remembering Parks' refusal to give up her seat on an Alabama bus over 40 years ago, sparking the American Civil Rights Movement. Attendees at the ceremony included Reverend Jesse Jackson, one-time segregationist Senator Strom Thurmond, and President Clinton, who reminded the audience of Mrs. Parks' impact on the American establishment. Rosa Parks reminded us all, Clinton noted, that for millions of Americans our history was full of weary years, our sweet land of liberty bearing only bitter fruit and silent tears. And at a recent Mormon assembly, President Gordon Hinckley announced plans to rebuild a historic Nauvoo Mormon temple in Illinois, nearly 150 years after arson and weather gutted it. In his presentation, Hinckley emphasized the spiritual importance of this site, reminding members that founder Joseph Smith laid its cornerstone in 1841. You're listening to Talking History. At least on paper, the United Nations, now nearly 55 years old, continues to be the primary international peacekeeping institution in the world. Just how well it has performed in that role, however, is the subject of a considerable debate. Taking a look at that debate and the history of the United Nations is Talking History's Terry Clark and his special guest, Paul Diehl.
Established in the aftermath of World War II, the United Nations was dominated by the U.S.-Soviet confrontation. However, changes in the Soviet Union released the organization from its Cold War paralysis. Nonetheless, the view has persisted among some in some sectors in the United States that the United Nations is largely unnecessary or ineffective. And more recently, in the Third World, concerns have emerged that it is a threat to sovereignty and national aspirations. Here today to help us understand these and other debates concerning the United Nations in the post-Cold War era is Professor Paul F. Diehl. Dr. Diehl is professor of political science at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and the author of International Peacekeeping with Johns Hopkins University Press and War and Peace in International Rivalry, published by the University of Michigan Press. Welcome to our show, Professor Diehl.
Thank you very much.
Let me start by asking you when the United Nations was created and for what purpose?
Well, the United Nations was first created, or the genesis of it, was in a conference in Washington, D.C. in 1944 and ultimately put together in 1945, christened in San Francisco. And the purpose of that international organization was very much like its predecessor, the League of Nations, 25 or more years before, which was to prevent another world war from happening. And And while the United Nations had some other purposes in terms of protecting human rights, promoting economic development, its main concern was keeping together the coalition of allies who were about to win the war in Europe and Asia and providing the basis for a peaceful world order for the years to come afterward.
So it had, as I take it then, about two purposes. One, the primary role, as you see it, was to provide for a more peaceful world. And the second one, it had this other ancillary function of promoting economic development. How well did it do in performing those two missions?
I think in keeping the peace, you'd have to give it, at best, a mixed report card. And I think, on the one hand, it clearly did not move ahead with the provisions that were in the UN Charter and the coalition of the United States, Soviet Union, Britain, France, and at that time, Nationalist China, did not stay together such that they could kind of keep world peace. And so clearly the UN's vision to end all wars clearly didn't end all wars, no more than the League of Nations did. On the other hand, some of its secondary purposes in terms of promoting economic development, protecting human rights, are still far from complete, but we've made tremendous progress with work of the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and in establishing international standards of human rights, such as the prohibition against genocide, the recent convention against torture, promotion of women's rights on the international level. So I think overall, when one looks at the activities of the UN, they've tended to do a lot better in the less controversial social, humanitarian, cultural areas than they have in some of the economic areas, and particularly in the most controversial, the security area that had the greatest difficulties.
I understand that the end of the Cold War has brought about some opportunities now for the United Nations, particularly in terms of this primary role of trying to encourage peace or to bring about world peace. What kinds of changes have occurred in the United Nations, particularly in terms of its role that it's taken on?
I think to get a handle on that, I think you really have to look at what some of its original purposes are and go back to how it behaved during the Cold War. And I think in the Cold War there were really two kinds of phases. One is an idealistic phase that didn't last very long at all, and then the reality of the Cold War set in. In the idealistic phase, which is really the first couple of years of the existence of the UN and evidenced in the provisions of the UN Charter, the UN was supposed to be an organization which would keep the police functioning almost as a world policeman, where military forces contributed by member states would act as a police force does and move to any part of the world to stamp out aggression or to take action to keep the peace. And this was supposed to be done by an international military force directed by military officials from the leading five powers. That kind of idealistic notion never really came about, primarily because of the differences between the United States and Soviet Union over ideology, over spheres of influence, things like that. What did happen then in the Cold War was that if the idealistic phase wasn't going to work, we didn't have those kind of provisions, were never going to come about, they moved into sort of the best compromise that they could do. And that's where you have the creation of what we now know as peacekeeping forces. Peacekeeping forces are neutral, lightly armed troops who during the Cold War were put in place following a ceasefire but prior to conflict resolution. So in some sense, they're not at all like international military forces who punish an aggressor, but they're really there to stabilize the situation after there's been a ceasefire and prevent a renewal of warfare. And during the Cold War, we saw up to a dozen, two dozen kinds of peacekeeping operations that were put in place only after a ceasefire. Those peacekeeping forces were not generally placed within the spheres of influence of either the U.S. or the Soviet Union, so there weren't generally any in the Western Hemisphere or in Eastern Europe, despite whatever conflicts might be taking place there. Starting with the Suez Crisis in 1956 and through the 1980s with many of the forces in the Middle East, that was the dominant way that the UN dealt with conflicts. It wasn't very good at preventing those conflicts. It didn't do well with assigning blame or punishing conflict, but at least it provided some measure of stability to hotspots like Cyprus or the Sinai Desert between Israel and Egypt, the Golan Heights between Syria and Israel. And that's kind of the very limited role, both geographically and military, that they could play. Now that brings us up to kind of the post-Cold War era, when the United Nations Security Council isn't quite as hamstrung by U.S.-Soviet tensions or disagreements among the major powers. And there's a number of interesting things start to happen with the end of the Cold War, and if we can call around 1988, 1989, 1990 as the signposts for that. There's some dramatic changes in what the U.N. does. First thing is, you notice, is that the U.N. suddenly starts to authorize many more peacekeeping missions than it did before. In the last 10 years, the U.N. has authorized more peacekeeping missions than it did in the first 40 years of its existence. And it's not just the number that's different, it's also the kind of missions that they're performing. First thing that you notice is that the United Nations is becoming more involved in conflicts that are internal or civil conflicts rather than just those between states. So whereas during the Cold War a typical peacekeeping mission might be placed between Israel and any of her neighbors, now suddenly UN peacekeepers are being sent to Somalia, Bosnia, and elsewhere, where it's fundamentally an internal conflict, something that in the past was considered out of bounds or outside the realm of authority for the United Nations. And along with that greater focus on internal conflicts, which now make up 80 to 90% of UN peacekeeping operations, the kind of missions that the peacekeepers were performing have also dramatically changed. During the Cold War, again, typically the soldiers merely sat there as a buffer or interposition force separating two states along a disputed border and did little than patrol those borders, make sure that the ceasefire was in place. In the post-Cold War era, we have a number of new missions. You have peacekeeping forces who are supervising elections, who are verifying arms control agreements, who are involved in rebuilding what's called failed, collapsed, or disrupted states, such as Somalia, and a range of other different kinds of what we call new missions, including humanitarian assistance, that they've never really done before and may not necessarily be well designed to do. So in some ways, I think that the post-Cold War has opened up a wide range of new opportunities, and it's really led the UN to venture into different kinds of missions and different kinds of conflicts that during the Cold War, either for political or legal reasons, it stayed out of. Now, one cautionary note I want to say, though, given that, is the new world order, as we call it, has not necessarily opened up the possibilities of going back to the original charter and envisioning the UN or the international community playing the role of international policemen, where it necessarily goes in and punishes those. The only exception we can see of that was during the Persian Gulf War in Iraq. But even then, that was clearly not a UN operation. It was an operation endorsed by the United Nations, but primarily carried out by a handful of states, where the decision to go to war, the decision to press the war against Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and the decision to actually stop that war were primarily made in Washington and other leading national capitals. So I think the post-Cold War has opened up new opportunities, but still the possibility of having some type of international army or national police force, I still think, is not present and is not likely to be so for many years.
You've outlined what appears to me, at least, to be substantial changes in what the United Nations is currently doing and what it's done before. Change always seems to engender a certain amount of, at least, if not concern, opposition. What have been the concerns that have been expressed to the opposition as a result of the UN's evolving role in the post-Cold War era?
I think there are a number of them, and much of it depends on from whose perspective you look at it from. From underdeveloped third world or less developed countries' perspective, I think there are several concerns. First, I think they have great concern that now the UN is involving itself in the internal affairs of countries. During the Cold War era, and indeed for much of the history of the modern international system, what went on inside the borders of a state was considered to be solely in the hands of that state and not something that was subject to international intervention or international concern. That's dramatically changed now, and many countries see it as a potential threat to their sovereignty, to their national development, if they believe that international organizations such as the UN or NATO can come in and dictate exactly how they should, what policies they should pursue, how they should treat ethnic minorities within their borders, and any of a range of different kinds of policies. And as much as many may decry the genocide in Kosovo or other problems, is many of those same countries worry about the precedent being set in places like Kosovo or Somalia, and they fear that the international community may intervene in their states later on over some type of issue. I think that's one concern for the third world states. A second concern is financial. There's been an argument made by many third world states that the New World Order and the emphasis on peacekeeping is draining resources and attention away from some of the traditional economic issues that have gone, that have been the main concern of those third world countries in the past. And with the end of the Cold War, what many third world countries look out and see that much of the economic aid that was given bilaterally or transferred to the UN development agencies, first they think is being, you know, diverted toward peacekeeping kinds of concerns, you know, rather than theirs. So in some sense, they don't see any peace dividend with the end of the Cold War. They see a net loss of resources. And the second thing that they see is a lot of the development aid that used to go to Africa and Asia is now being concentrated in the developing democracies and to facilitate economic transition in Eastern Europe. So for them, the end of the Cold War has really led to a reorientation of the UN away from some of their interests and a draining resources to some of their main kinds of concerns. Now, from the perspective of the United States and much of the West, one of the main concerns, I think, of the post-Cold War era has been financial, in the sense that in 1994, I believe, the UN peacekeeping budget was actually greater than the entire regular UN budget for the first time in history. And there's become increasing concern, particularly in the halls of Congress, but also in other national capitals in Europe as well, that the UN is expanding too fast. It's trying to deal with too many conflicts. And the bill for that, several billion dollars a year, is far more than the organization can or should support.
Going back to the issue of the United Nations' role in terms of creating a safe or secure world order, NATO is a part of that plan in some way. It's central to this evolving European security structure architecture that we hear much about. What's going to be the relationship, or what is the evolving relationship between NATO and the United Nations?
I'm not sure that the NATO-UN relationship is really stabilized yet. I think we've already tried a couple different variations, and I don't think we've settled on an alternative that really works yet. Clearly, NATO is an organization that's looking for a new mission. Its traditional mission of deterrence and defense against an invasion from the Soviet Union's allies has little relevance in the post-Cold War world. And that leaves it to decide what to do with its military might. Now, on the one hand, the first test of that in the post-Cold War was the original Bosnian conflict. And in that, there was an attempt to have some type of partnership between NATO and the UN, where UN peacekeepers would be on the ground in Bosnia, that NATO would provide air support, as well as calling in would be the source of bombing raids that were authorized by the UN and NATO. That type of partnership was very uneasy. You had two very different kinds of organizations. One, a very traditional military alliance made up of Western states, and the other, a large multi-nation alliance that has very little military component, trying to coordinate planning. And there was a number of serious mistakes, problems, and otherwise, in coordinating policy, approving of bombing raids, etc., in Bosnia. And that didn't work out particularly well. After the Dayton Peace Accords in Bosnia and now in Kosovo, in many ways, I see NATO as not necessarily working in partnership with the UN, but in many cases replacing the UN for missions that require greater coercion and military might. So after the Dayton Peace Accords, NATO peacekeepers move in to replace UN troops. We have 60,000 troops instead of 20,000 UN troops. We have more heavily armed troops. And now in Kosovo, the UN is virtually not a player at all, and most of the action is being dictated by what NATO wants to do. So in some ways, I see it much more likely that NATO is a substitute for the UN, primarily confined to Europe, and more likely to take on missions that require more military force or power. I still don't think that they've established the kind of working relationship where you can see a true partnership to deal with problems in Europe or in the periphery.
In the remaining few seconds we have left, maybe you could comment just very briefly on what you see as the likely future of the United Nations.
I think there's going to be a scaling back at least in the next couple of years. You've already seen that in the sense that the UN initially had an explosion of new missions, but the New World Order, before it was a pejorative term, was an idea that the UN would play a much greater role. But the failures in Rwanda, Somalia, and Bosnia, I think it's going to lead the UN to pick and choose a lot more carefully the kinds of missions that it does. And I wouldn't be surprised at all to see regional organizations step in, not just NATO, but the Organization of African Unity, other than Asia, and carry some of the burden that I think that the UN might have thought it was going to do earlier in this decade.
Professor Deal, I want to thank you very much for being our guest today.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Dr. Paul Deal, Professor of Political Science at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign.
Continuing our focus this week on the United Nations, for our op-ed, we now turn to Thomas Weiss to get his thoughts on the relationship between the United States and the United Nations. Weiss is Presidential Professor of History at the Graduate School and University Center of the City University of New York. In July 2000, he becomes one of the editors of Global Governance. His latest book is Military-Civilian Interactions, Intervening in Humanitarian Crises. Professor Weiss has titled his op-ed, American Ambivalence Toward the UN.
Having bypassed the Security Council to avoid Russian and Chinese vetoes, NATO began bombing in the Balkans without international approval. On the one hand, it is encouraging that ethnic cleansing and war crimes were important enough to proceed anyhow. On the other hand, the hapless Clinton administration found that all options for a face-saving exit from the Kosovo fiasco relied upon a marginalized United Nations. Washington's inconsistency seems curious to many diplomats and observers, but it reflects U.S. military and economic strength. Many Western allies and virtually all third world countries are viscerally supportive of the UN because they cannot act unilaterally. Moreover, the flip-flop between international cooperation and going it alone is hardly new. The last of President Woodrow Wilson's 14 points laid the groundwork for the League of Nations, but this great experiment was rejected by Congress. President Franklin Roosevelt advocated a vigorous United Nations even before the U.S. entered World War II. And after the defeat of Germany and Japan, U.N. headquarters were located in New York, and the United States paid the lion's share of the budget. From champion to chump would summarize the change in American attitudes toward the World Organization by the mid-1970s, when the automatic majority of newly independent but largely pro-Soviet third world countries poisoned the atmosphere. By the mid-1980s, UN bashing became a favorite sport along the Potomac, and the United States failed to pay its assessed bills. Suddenly, the UN returned to the limelight after the Berlin Wall's collapse. The post-Cold War era initially reinvigorated the Security Council when none other than George Bush discovered a new world order. Sobriety returned after failures in Bosnia, Somalia, and Rwanda. And Washington remained the biggest financial deadbeat. Would American interests be better served by consistent international cooperation rather than opportunistic ambivalence? Does the defense of U.S. territory and stability in important markets, for example, not justify collaboration to ensure a world in which genocide and rape are not policy options, in which international efforts to curb terrorism are improved? Do core American values not include prosecuting war criminals and helping to return refugees to their homes? In the past, the UN often has been helpful to the pursuit of foreign policy objectives, and Washington continues to need a healthy world organization. If it did not exist, the adage goes, we would have to invent it. Ironically, the United States invented the UN in the first place. We should be steadfast rather than inconsistent, and strengthen rather than weaken our commitments to the United Nations.
You've been listening to Thomas Weiss, Presidential Professor of History at the Graduate School and University Center of the City University of New York. This is Talking History. Welcome back to Talking History for our recommended historic site of the week. In case you're planning a trip abroad this summer, we've selected an historic city in Spain. Here to tell you more about this lovely historic city is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Toledo, Spain is located 1.5 hours south of Madrid by train. It is Spain's religious capital, spiritual center, its holy city. The castled city has maintained the atmosphere and structure of an old medieval fortress. The maze of narrow streets make you want to explore the city that blends old and new. It is a modern city that houses a rich history and is an art lover's paradise. The most famous adoptive son of Toledo was artist El Greco. Much of his work is housed in churches and museums throughout the city, including the El Greco Museum. There are many architectural treasures to be found in Toledo, which few cities can compare with. The most noticeable is the great cathedral that dominates the city's skyline, which was originally built in 1212 and completed in 1493.
Thank you, Cindy. And turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, we have three Civil War musters and reenactments to call to the attention of Civil War buffs. On August 28th and 29th, a Civil War muster will be held in Jackson County, Michigan. Battles will take place on both days, as well as brigade drills, a military ball, ladies' programs, and a period church service. On September 25th through the 27th, the Civil War Sailor and Marine Association will hold its annual convention in Wildwood Crest, New Jersey. The New Jersey event will feature a sea battle and naval and marine reenactment. On the same weekend, September 25th and 26th, a bit further to the west, Gettysburg National Military Park will host its 136th anniversary reenactment of the Battle of Gettysburg. Your choice. But for detailed information on any or all of these opportunities, contact the Jackson County Parks Office in Michigan, the Civil War Sailor and Marine Association in New Jersey, and Gettysburg National Park in Pennsylvania. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week for our show on Watergate. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.